the older people were running around wild. They thought it was the end of the world, you know. Everything was shaken.
Kind of a low roar. You had the feeling that the roof was coming off.
It was a six-story brick building. We were on the third floor. When we finally got out of the building, we were on the top floor. The top three had gone off.
By night, the city looked like the whole downtown area was on fire.
Everything was burnt. The home was gone. Everything was gone. So.
Those are voices of people who survived the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire. And they're just some of the rare recordings you're going to hear in Voices for the Environment, a century of Bay Area activism. This podcast accompanies an exhibition in the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley that's the first major effort to bring together both the oral history and archival collections of the Bancroft Library. You're about to hear more voices recorded by UC Berkeley's Oral History Center, founded in 1953 to record and preserve the history of California, the nation, and our interconnected world. Voices for the Environment traces the evolution of environmentalism in the San Francisco Bay Area across the 20th century and highlights how Bay Area activists have long been on the front lines of environmental change, starting with efforts to preserve natural spaces in the wake of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire. We'll also learn about the mid-century fight for state environmental protections and demands to address the disproportionate burden of pollution that sickened communities of color across the Bay. You're listening to the first episode of Voices for the Environment. We're calling it A Preservationist Spirit. I'm your host, Sasha Coca from KQED. A beautiful vista, an ancient forest, a flooded valley. Our relationships with the world around us define who we are, from the air and water that sustains us, to the natural spaces we enjoy, to the creatures we share our surroundings with. Together, we refer to these intertwined elements as the environment. Sometimes we struggle with how to change those relationships. We call that work environmentalism. In the San Francisco Bay Area, a new environmental spirit was flourishing in the first decade of the 20th century. The catalyst for this public activism was not pollution, oil spills, or climate change. Not yet. Back then, it was the 1906 earthquake and fire. On the morning of April 18th, 1906, a massive earthquake struck just 2 miles off the coast of San Francisco, then California's largest city. The quake, with an estimated magnitude of 7.9, was absolutely devastating. Thousands of buildings crumbled to the streets, reducing vast sections of the city to rubble. The recordings you're about to hear are rare firsthand accounts of people from the Bay Area who survived the harrowing event. These interviewees were children back in 1906, and they recounted their experiences decades later.
I was 10 years old. I'd just had a 10th birthday, but I had never heard of an earthquake. I didn't know the word.
We woke up, shake you right out of the bed, but we couldn't get out. The house boxed and the doors jammed, and had a heck of a time.
My mother got us into the doorway and stood us there, and she said, "Now stand right here," and she stood us right in the doorway, "stand right here." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And we could look across the room and out the building and see the buildings collapsing out there.
But when the earthquake came, 1906, the day of the earthquake, my mother had a baby girl born that morning. She was ill all evening, all night. The earthquake was so strong that we lived on the first floor, on the third floor, balcony, everything fell down on the floor. Our kitchen caught fire. There was my father. So finally, there was a little Irish lady lived next door to her with two young sons. I think they were 17, 19 at the time. Her sons broke the windows and took mother a mattress, baby, and all, brought them outside on the sidewalk. I remember that like yesterday.
So my father said, "We've got to get up. We've got to get up and dress." First thing, we went out in the street. We could smell gas. People were all out of their homes in their pajamas and their nightshirts and so on. Wanted to see what happened. And Well, it wasn't until later in the morning when we fully dressed and went out and down the street with the streetcar and Geary. The rails were all up in the air and bent, and big gaps. You couldn't wonder how far down it went. Big gaping holes.
And we watched people go by with empty bird cages and wheeling empty baby buggies and you know, in a state of complete shock.
As devastating as the earthquake was for San Francisco, it was fire that caused most of the damage. The quake ruptured gas mains all throughout the city, sparking nearly three dozen fires, producing an inferno that burned for 3 days straight. To make matters worse, firefighters and residents in San Francisco soon ran out of water.
And then about noon time, we got word the city's on fire and there's no water.
We didn't have a stitch of clothes on, just an up-top shirt. Couldn't get anything. Went back thinking he would be able to save some. Everything was burnt. You couldn't, the home was gone. Everything was gone. So we didn't.
And we had gotten some blankets from my aunt. And, of course, we went out with nothing from our building except what we were wearing. And we got some blankets from my aunt. And we slept in that, we stayed in that lot. And that's my first recollection of the fire, because from there we could watch everything burn. And
no water and a raging fire left city officials only one option: to create fire blocks by dynamiting the buildings that stood in the fire's path so there would be nothing left to burn.
We watched them blast down on Valencia Street and down on Mission Street, sort of backfiring, mm-hmm. You know, watching them blast the old mm-hmm. theater out there, the Valencia Theater. And we slept under the blankets that night and had to wake up every once in a while and shake them because they were heavy with ashes.
I recall going to where the Mint is today, watch the fire from where the Mint is on that hill. We could see the fire burning downtown from here in Baker.
It's the school up, it's right up in the hill here, mm-hmm. Lone Mountain mm-hmm. College. Mm-hmm. It was a bare hill at that time. That's where the name Lone Mountain came to be. So we walked up there, and by night, the city was, looked like the whole downtown area was on fire.
Mr. Shields had an automobile. He was the third neighbor to us there. So we went down in Market Street. Here is the Palace Hotel, and we were here. And we saw the windows go boom, boom, from the heat.
Here are some more recollections of what became known as the Great Fire of 1906.
And we could see the flames, you know, the fire from the hills, you know, that were burning all the houses. And the Fairmont Hotel was being built at the time, and it wasn't finished. And the fire was all around there, but I don't think it did that much damage there. But just like it was over the sky above us.
I can recall the first night when the city was on fire, saying nothing, but standing there next to my father. I cried and cried, and finally looked down at me. He says, what can you do about it? He said, well, I said, there goes San Francisco.
When the last fire was finally extinguished, San Francisco lay in ruins. The earthquake and fire had claimed over 3,000 lives and destroyed 80% of what was then the largest and richest city west of Chicago. Within weeks, the mission to rebuild San Francisco got underway. What you may not know is that the plan to rebuild involved cutting down some of California's ancient redwood forests. Coastal redwood trees, known scientifically as Sequoia sempervirens, are among the largest and oldest organisms living on Earth. They've survived along California's coast for at least 20 million years, some of them reaching more than 300 feet high and 20 feet wide. That giant size made them a prime timber source to rebuild the devastated city, especially because redwood is pretty fire resistant. That started a logging frenzy. Timber interests like the Redwood Car Shippers Bureau circulated promotional photos showing buildings constructed out of redwood still standing amid a burned out San Francisco skyline. In the years that followed, lumber mills up and down the coast worked overtime to meet the city's endless demand, and record shipments of redwood made their way to San Francisco Bay. And here's where the earthquake and fire led to an early call for environmental preservation. Bay Area residents, including John Muir and other members of the newly formed Sierra Club, spearheaded the effort to stop logging redwoods. Muir was an immigrant from Scotland who fell in love with the Sierra Nevada. In the late 1800s, he settled in the Bay Area city of Martinez. In 1892, he and other Bay Area residents founded the Sierra Club with an early mission to explore, preserve, and protect California's mountains and forests. They feared the logging frenzy to rebuild San Francisco had already taken its toll on the region's redwoods. Take the area around Palo Alto. Located 30 miles south on the peninsula, the city got its name from surrounding redwood forests. Palo Alto means tall tree in Spanish. In the years after the earthquake and fire, that reference would be lost, though, because rebuilding San Francisco depleted those tall tree forests. Concerned residents throughout the Bay Area reacted quickly. They started lobbying the state and federal government to protect the region's remaining redwood groves. State officials responded by expanding the boundaries of Big Basin Redwood State Park in the Santa Cruz Mountains. It's California's first and oldest state park, founded in 1902. Over the decades, the protected area of Big Basin would steadily expand to include some 18,000 acres. That's six times as big as the park's original boundaries. Federal officials took action to preserve the redwoods, too. In 1908, Bay Area Congressman William Kent led the charge to federally protect 295 acres of redwood forest in Marin County, just north of San Francisco. The preserved area is known as Muir Woods National Monument. Here's what John Muir wrote to Kent shortly after the monument's creation. "Saving these redwoods from the axe and saw, from money changers and water changers, and giving them to our country and the world is in many ways the most notable service to God and man I've heard of since my forest wandering began." John Muir and other men became figureheads of environmental preservation, but women played a critical yet often overlooked role in early environmental activism, too. Women provided much of the grassroots momentum to save California's redwoods through letter writing, lobbying, fundraising, and leading various organizations. Women in the Semper Virens Club and California Club were instrumental to the creation of protected areas like Big Basin Redwood State Park, Muir Woods National Monument, and Calaveras Big Trees State Park. The creation of these protected areas forced timber companies to concentrate their operations in more remote regions along the north and central coasts. But the activists in women's organizations, from the California Federation of Women's Clubs to the Women's Save the Redwood League, kept pushing to protect those regions too. Men may have cast the votes in Congress and state government to protect redwood forests, but it was the activism of women throughout California that helped put these issues on the table in the first place. Here's UC Berkeley environmental historian Carolyn Merchant.
Women had power, but they had power through their roles in a traditional patriarchal society, so that they could do more things within that patriarchy than had been thought of before. And so women began to feel a sense of power, a sense of what they could do, and that they actually can assert that power in order to help save the planet, and how women themselves can become important forces in the whole role of conservation and resources.
The tug of war between the development of cities like San Francisco and preservation of California's redwood forests, that was a fight that would continue for decades, putting the focus on humans rather than fire or pests as the primary threat to these ancient trees and their environments. This battle helped ignite and expand the preservationist spirit that would shape environmental activism in the Bay Area for the next century. San Francisco had long impacted environments well beyond its city boundaries. In the wake of the 1906 earthquake and fire, the city's efforts to rebuild began to affect more remote regions of the state, including areas previously protected by preservationists. And as rebuilding San Francisco continued, the city began to need not just trees, but water. In 1908, city leaders proposed a project to provide a reliable water source for San Franciscans. The scale of the idea was unprecedented. They wanted to dam the Hetch Hetchy Valley, which was then preserved as part of Yosemite National Park. The plan was to engineer a system to carry the water 160 miles to San Francisco, what used to be a two-day stagecoach ride before the Yosemite Valley Railroad opened in 1907. The proposal to dam Hetch Hetchy sparked a five-year debate from San Francisco City Hall to the steps of Congress in Washington, D.C. The preservationists who opposed the dam were led by John Muir and other Sierra Club officials. They argued Hetch Hetchy Valley was a sacred piece of Yosemite National Park. If it were sacrificed to bring water to San Francisco, that would set a dangerous precedent for tapping into resources in all kinds of protected areas.
Another outstanding matter that came before the Sierra Club for action, and John Muir was strongly behind it, was what we refer to as the Hetch Hetchy fight. The Hetch Hetchy Valley had been included in Yosemite National Park largely as a result of John Muir's efforts.
That was Anders Hauge reading the oral history of William E. Colby, who stood on the front lines with John Muir during the Hetch Hetchy campaign. Colby, who was born and raised in the Bay Area, held the post of Secretary of the Sierra Club for more than 40 years. He led campaigns to expand Sequoia National Park, as well as create Olympic and Kings Canyon National Parks. Here's Hauge again reading from Colby's 1953 oral history about how he cut his political teeth in the fight to keep Hetch Hetchy preserved.
San Francisco became interested in acquiring this as a municipal water supply. When we heard of it, of course, John Muir was tremendously exercised to think that a great part of his work would be undone. And so the Sierra Club very strongly opposed this application by the city of San Francisco. We were successful in granting the grant for a number of years.
But city developers pushed back. Creating a viable water supply, that was progress. It would help bring fresh water to a thirsty city. Developers also drew heavily on the imagery of a vulnerable San Francisco left without water in the face of a raging fire. The 1906 earthquake and fire was the first natural disaster captured on film, so advocates for the dam had lots of material to help make their case.
But the tide turned when Woodrow Wilson became president, because he named Franklin K. Lane, who had been city attorney of San Francisco when the application of the Hetch Hetchy site had been made, Secretary of the Interior. Because of this change in the political situation, we found that we were at great disadvantage. We had tremendous support from many sources, but this political change was too powerful for us. We even enlisted the support of civil engineers, hydraulic engineers, who aided us in preparing reports showing there were half a dozen other sources of supply that San Francisco could have obtained. And that was absolutely demonstrated later on by the fact that Oakland went over to the Mequalamie River and obtained a very fine water supply and brought it into Oakland long before San Francisco got the Hetch Hetchy supply. We were handicapped in every direction.
In the end, Congress sided with the city of San Francisco, passing the 1913 Ranker Act, which permitted the flooding of Hetch Hetchy Valley in Yosemite, and the construction of the massive O'Shaughnessy Dam with an extensive water delivery system. Colby recalled in his 1953 oral history how this decision impacted his friend and mentor, John Muir.
The loss of Hetch Hetchy Valley was a tremendous blow to John Muir. I'm quite sure that this loss of the Hetch Hetchy Valley had a great deal to do with Mr. Muir's subsequent illness and ultimate death. He probably died in advance of the time that he would have if the attempt to save Hetch Hetchy had not gone against him. Muir didn't mince any words in expressing his ideas of the tremendous loss to the nation by reason of the flooding of the Hetch Hetchy Valley.
John Muir died in December of 1914, 1 year after Congress voted to authorize San Francisco's plan to dam the Hetch Hetchy Valley. Decades later, native San Franciscan and famed photographer Ansel Adams shared his grief over the loss of Hetch Hetchy, Adams joined the Sierra Club shortly after Muir's death and would build his career photographing Yosemite National Park.
We lost a head chief, but a big disappointment there was Gifford Pinchot's support of it. See, he really turned the trick for the Secretary of the Interior.
Gifford Pinchot was America's first professionally trained forester. From 1898 through 1910, he served three American presidents in the U.S. Department of Agriculture as the nation's chief of forestry. He also became a major supporter of damming the Hetch Hetchy Valley. If John Muir became a figurehead for the preservation of nature, Pinchot's early leadership of the U.S. Forest Service symbolized the corporate and multi-use model of natural resources.
People forget the Forest Service is primarily a commercially oriented, but really a controlling administration. It's just recently that they've been stressing many uses for political reasons. It sounds very fine, and in many ways is all right. But when you get into very beautiful areas that should have park and monument status, see, it doesn't work.
As Adams recalls, the Hetch Hetchy site was not just about getting water, but hydroelectricity for the growing city of San Francisco. That would help build the power grid of the utility giant Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E.
The Hetch Hetchy, where are you going to get your water? San Francisco, that's our water supply. That. And San Francisco, that is a big community. And the Russian River was considered. See, what happened there was that there was another site further down that would be much bigger in expanse, not so deep. And we worked for that very hard, but that would not provide enough power. There wouldn't be enough fall. The whole Hetch Hetchy was put where it is in the Hetch Hetchy Valley because of the favorable power situation.
Some of the defenders of Hetch Hetchy came from San Francisco's business community, like Francis Farquhar. He was a Harvard-educated accountant who joined the Sierra Club a year after moving to San Francisco in 1910. He would serve more than 25 years on the club's board of directors, including two terms as Sierra Club president. Here's Ross Bradford reading from Farquhar's 1958 oral history.
I never participated in the Hetch Hetchy matter. I was in Boston at the time the bill finally passed. I'd seen it in 1911 when I came out to the Sierra Club outing with Jim Rennie. We came all the way down the Tuolumne Canyon and camped in the Hetch Hetchy Valley a day or two. I recognized its beauty.
For Farquhar, the devastating loss of Hetch Hetchy had a silver lining, because although tragic, it may have provided one of the most powerful and lasting influences for what would become the environmental movement in the U.S.
I think it is too bad that the national park idea had not developed further at the time to prevent the surrender of such an important portion of a national park. Possibly the fact that Hetch Hetchy was surrendered strengthened the whole national park idea with the slogan, "Never another Hetch Hetchy."
Few activists in America likely use that slogan as effectively as David Brower. Many consider him the godfather of the modern environmental movement. He's from Berkeley and served as the first executive director of the Sierra Club from 1952 to 1969. He oversaw a tenfold expansion of the club's membership and led campaigns to establish 10 new national parks. Brower also pioneered the use of film, books, and other media to advocate for environmental causes. One of those was the fight against a proposed dam on the Colorado River in Dinosaur National Monument.
I didn't go to Dinosaur until 1953. That was the year the Sierra Club started to run river trips that were patterned after a river trip that Harold Bradley had taken his family on the year before. He went there to make a film and made a family film, showed it around, and that certainly is one of the things that awakened my interest in what was there.
When the dam proposal came to Congress, Brower and other environmentalists waged an all-out campaign to preserve Dinosaur National Monument.
It did, at least it was important to the Sierra Club. It was important to a lot of the conservation organizations where they could really take the establishment and stop it. There were all kinds of, that is, whatever led Newton Drury to say dinosaur is a dead duck was a force that was reversed. and it was reversed to a battle that had a nationwide audience. And we got persuaded a good many of the people whose voices were heard in Congress, that if there are a lot of people, but you find a few of the leaders and get them to go, and you're in fairly good shape.
In his oral history, Brower says the similarity of the dam project in Dinosaur to Hetch Hetchy was striking. He highlighted that parallel in his advocacy film, The Two Yosemites.
There was one other thing that really worked pretty hard, worked well in our lobbying effort, and that was the lowest budget film on record, the one I did on Two Yosemites. The budget was, I guess, 5 rolls of Kodachrome film in my own time. And I did the editing, and I wrote the script, and then I recorded it, and we put out this film. It was an 11-minute film, and we made 6 copies of it. I showed those a good many places, and it had quite an impact. That is, what had been done to Hetch Hetchy, and all the claims that were made of how beautiful a lake it would be, and how great a recreational resource, and of course it wasn't. It isn't. It wasn't necessary. And the parallel with Dinosaur was so beautiful that we worked on that constantly.
The other Yosemite was only a little less beautiful than this one, and a few miles to the north, Hetch Hetchy Valley. John Muir, the Sierra Club, and other conservation groups fought hard against this destructive park invasion. San Francisco argued that without this water, it would wither. It must have this cheap power. There were no good alternatives, and the dam would enhance the beauty of the place and make it more accessible. The greatest good for the greatest number. Teeming San Francisco against the few people who had yet visited Yosemite. Not one of the city's claims has proved valid.
David Brower's activism, along with efforts of other preservationists, did prove successful. In 1955, the Secretary of the Interior withdrew the proposal for the dam at Dinosaur National Monument. And that campaign was just one of many environmental efforts Brower would lead from Sierra Club headquarters in the Bay Area. By the late 1960s, Brower's leadership would elevate the Sierra Club's national profile, transforming it from a California-based group to one of the largest and most influential environmental organizations in North America. We've heard how a new and bustling San Francisco arose from the ashes of the 1906 earthquake and fire. So did a robust and ever-growing spirit of preservation, a force that would shape environmentalism in the Bay Area and beyond for well over the next century. The activism that began to preserve the state's ancient redwood forests would result in 49 state and federally protected redwood parks in California. And the legacy of the Hetch Hetchy fight helped inform the preservation of landscapes across the U.S., 423 federally protected areas, to be exact. Yet in the middle of the 20th century, environmentalism in the Bay Area once again found itself at a crossroads. The post-war development boom forced a choice between protecting the environment and using natural resources to meet the needs of a growing population. You can hear that story in our next episode of Voices for the Environment. You've been listening to A Preservationist Spirit, the first of 3 episodes in the podcast Voices for the Environment, A Century of Bay Area Activism. It's part of an exhibition in the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley that runs from October 2023 through November 2024. This episode featured historic interviews from the Oral History Center archives in the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley, including segments from the Growing Up in the Cities Project, recorded by Frederick M. Wirt, and oral history interviews with Ansel Adams, Carolyn Merchant, and David Brower. The oral history of William E. Colby was voiced by Anders Haugie, and the oral history of Francis Farquhar was voiced by Ross Bradford. To learn more about these interviews and the Oral History Center, visit the website listed in the show notes. This podcast was produced by Todd Holmes and Roger Eardley Pryor, with help from me, Sasha Coca. Thanks to KQED Public Radio and the California Report magazine. I'm your host, Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening.